After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
Hi, everyone. It's Raghu with Mind Rolling. We're back, and I'm back with Conda Mason, who is new to the podcast, but won't be for very long. Conda, welcome.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you. Conda, I met through Jack Kornfield, and Conda teaches at Spirit Rock, which is what the trio of Vipassana family folks started a long time ago. And it also, of course, includes IMS in Massachusetts, where Joseph Goldstein and Sharon are more located. You know what, Conda? As I went through and did a little bit of homework in terms of looking at all the different things you do, oh my God, you are a Renaissance woman, if I ever saw one. I mean, I didn't know you were actually an audio engineer, right?
I took audio. Yes, I did. Yes. I took audio back in the day, but that was back when it was analog.
Yeah.
Okay.
It sounded better, right?
Yes, it actually did. We had tapes and we actually spliced tapes.
Yeah, right. And a filmmaker, you've done that as well.
Yeah.
And yoga, you have taught yoga, right?
Yeah.
Which I loved hearing about, by the way, not just the asana practice. Yoga in its true depth and breath, right?
Yeah.
So you've done that.
I hope so.
You started Impact Hub in Oakland, which I want you to just tell us a little bit about that, because that's really far reaching, that work that you did.
Yeah, it's a beautiful space. It's a physical space, brick and mortar space, an old car dealership, two of them that we opened up and made this incredibly beautiful 15,000 square foot space in downtown Oakland, right in the heart of Oakland. And it's a space for the movement to change the world, really. That's what I think of it as. It's like Oakland is already that movement. And then we're the home of where that movement lives. And so a lot of entrepreneurs, nonprofits, for-profit people who are really doing wonderful projects, and we're the space where people convene and where they work out of, and it's called Impact Hub Oakland, and it's quite a force.
It's incredible work, actually. So you see all of these many, many paths that Conda has taken and assimilated, and none the least of which is, of course, her Dharma teaching and her, wonderful initiatives around inclusion, which is highly, highly important in this age of polarity and exclusion. So, but you know what? Here's something for you that in terms of if somebody says to me, okay, well, who is Conda? And I'm going to say, and this I picked up somewhere, she's a manifestation and recipient of unconditional love.
Oh, yeah. That's the number one.
That's
number one. You know, when anybody asks me to introduce myself, I have to go back to my family. Mm. It's the first place where I began, like all of us. And I was really fortunate And whatever the karma was that brought me into my family, I was loved my whole life, and I knew it. And we have the most amazing family, and brothers and sisters. I'm the youngest of four, and truthfully, two of them have passed away. My brothers are gone. It's just me and my sister, and you might even hear her in the background. We live together, but we were loved. And I am the recipient of love. I learned how to love. And that's what I'm about. Yeah.
You know, I say this often, quote His Holiness the Dalai Lama, that we will, and I'm using some of my own translation here, but we will be saved in the future by mothers who have unconditionality in their love and compassion. And that is what's going to be passed on. And as that's passed on, that is going to be the basis of a transformation, which needs to happen. So it's, you know, it's interesting. I did a podcast with a man named Aubrey Marcus on his podcast. He's very well known, and he does a lot of different things, including as a fitness company and so on. And he loved Ram Dass, so he wanted to talk to me on his show about his feelings around Ram Dass and Ram Dass's passing and all of it. And at one point, because he asked me about Neem Karoli Baba, you know, our guru, and what that manifestation was like being around, all of that. And then at one point he said, you know, my own, I can't say guru in this life, but leading light for me in this life was my mother, because she gave me unconditional love. And I said, Aubrey, no different. That thing there that you got is absolutely no different than when we were sitting with this being and having that unconditionality just in a pool that we could enter into. There is only one thing going on, you know. Yeah. And now you're the first two people that I've heard in a long time that had this to say about their family. I mean, it's not common.
It's rare. You know, I used to not talk about it because I didn't realize that wasn't as common until I got to college, and my roommate hated her mother. And I thought, what? And I couldn't fathom it. Right. And I was like, just deep listening to people, and everyone around me had these issues. And I thought, oh my God, I can't even fathom it. So I got quiet about it. You know, I kind of got quiet, and I felt like I was in this little club by myself, and I didn't want to make people feel bad, you know, because it's hard to have mudita around things like that. You know what I mean? Right. And so it was like, and then recently I've started talking about it because I think that it gives people permission, because I got to tell you something. My mother did not have what she gave us. So it's not like
really
love begets love. Right, begets right. Love. No, she had a very rough situation. But yet she somehow said, I'm not going to do that. And she passed on so that all four of us felt like we were the most special person. And all of us felt that way. And we looked and we loved each other. And it's just been like the best family one could ever imagine I come from. And I feel like I feel like there's hope for any of us that didn't get that, because she didn't get that, but yet she created that. And so we can make choices around that, around what we do at our hearts and how we want to and who we want to be in the world. It is, we think that there's no choice, but you know, and there's trauma and all that. And listen, I give total credence to the trauma. I mean, because the truth of the matter is that I can look at my life with the trauma in it. My family all died. My mother's gone, my father's gone, and my two brothers are gone. Just me and my sister left. And it was hard. It was really hard. Both of my brothers died in my arms. They were my best friends. And I can look at, and they died way too young. My family has this weird kidney disease that killed everybody. And so I can look at that and say, oh my God, look at how horrible my family, everybody died. And yet, that's not the choice that I make. I look at, you know, I'd rather have I always think, do you want to have a short family with a lot of love, but it goes really quickly? for a long time with people that is not so good. And so, you know, I got the goat short one. And I'm just grateful for it. And even in their dying, and especially in their dying, was a gift in what I learned about my practice. And so I, you know, it's we all have hope to have love in our hearts. I believe that in spite of everything that has happened to us.
Yeah.
Or in addition to.
Yeah. So back then when you were a youngster and growing up, and was it in Oakland? Did you grow up in Oakland?
No, I grew up in Southern California. In a place, we started in San Bernardino and moved out to a little suburb outside of San Bernardino called Rialto. And that's where I grew up.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So I always ask people that I haven't chatted with on the podcast before, what were the transformation points for you just in terms of being conscious there is a path, as the Buddha said, there is a path and we can follow it and we can become free. When did all of that sort of get realized in you so that you actually took one foot in front of the other steps?
You know, when I think about that question, to me, I don't remember it not being. What I remember is when it went away and then came back. So I believe that, like as a kid, I was that kid that was in a trance practically, you know. I literally, like, I mean, I've only told people this a couple of times in a Dharma talk, but I was a kid, when I went to bed at night, I would actually turn into little particles and be in the atmosphere, and it was just bigness, and I always was this deep connection, and then I kind of materialized back into my bed, and I never talked about it, but it was this vastness and this connection, and that stopped happening finally, you know. You know, luckily you grow up and you kind of, but I always had this connection of a path. And you know, we grew up Baptist back in the day, and I loved the church. I loved it. You know, they introduced us to it, and my parents did, and then everybody stopped going but me. It was like, okay, I introduced you, you could do your own thing, and I would just drive myself, you know, they gave me the car to drive myself to church when I was way before I should have been driving, take the back roads, and I loved it. I loved the spirit of it, I loved the music, I was in the choir, and then that changed for me. You know, it wasn't about that religion for me, but there was still, I was always connected. And the big thing is that I remember when I disconnected, and that was when, you know, this relative world in 1967, my family moved from our little town in San Bernardino to a little tiny town called Rialto. And we were the third Black family in the whole town in 1967. And it wasn't pretty. It was really hard. And the things that was said to me and the way I was treated, and I lost that. It's like somebody put the lights out, and my lights went out, and I disconnected. And I got to tell you something. It was when I got to Berkeley, where I went to college, when I discovered Kundalini yoga. I went into a Kundalini class. I had never done yoga before. And I go into this Kundalini class. And man, after such a rigorous workout and then laying there in Savasana, I felt that connection again. I felt that vastness that I am. And I got addicted to Kundalini yoga, and I went back and back, and that brought my path back. So, but there were those years that were really dormant, and when racism was really what it was that separated me from myself. So that's kind of more my story. I feel like I was always on the path.
It was racism racism that separated me from myself. Talk about that. I don't, you know, because that's not, it's hard for people not of color to understand what that is. And that's a, you know, it's not, it's very, you know, the way it's internalized and what's happening to you inside, you know. Can you just talk about that for a sec?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, first of all, I was given a message at home that I was Black and beautiful and could do anything I wanted to do. And you could be the first, you'd probably be the first Black female president of the United States. I mean, that was my mother's story, right? So I was fed just so much positive reinforcement. And then I walk into a place that's just the opposite, where the world, and my mother knew that, you know, she was savvy and older and knew that, you know, what we were getting fed at home was going to be different than what I was going to be fed in the world. And when you have that, you're ugly and you're this and you're that and all the things that, you know, actually, I was at the top of my class when I left my school in reading. I was always good in school and, you know, did school, loved school, did well in it. When I moved to Rialto, sixth grade, they put me back. There was no reason for that. I was in the class where the people who were more remedial. And I was like, oh, you know, and that was just what they did to me. And so I'm getting off of different messages in the world than I am at home. And so that was really quite, and so my mother just doubled down more and just continued to tell me, that is not who you are. You know who you are. And so the messages in the world are brutal. You know, racism is brutal. People don't know. I mean, white folks don't really understand what it's like. It's brutal. And I was young and impressionable and started questioning myself at a time when I was really confident. And I started to question myself, and that internalizes that question. Am I good enough? Am I this? I never had that question. Am I good enough? People have that question. Am I good enough? I could never understand it. How can you have a question? Are you good enough? Of course you're good enough. And those questions started in my head. And then, you know, so it, I, you know, the self-talk started to undermine me, my own self-talk, taking in what was happening in the external world. And so it took, again, the intensity of another internal world practice, internal practice like Kundalini, which took me to meditation, which took me into those practices that where I, again, felt deeply connected by who I really was. And knowing that, the difference between what was out there in the external world and what is really going on in this internal world. And so it was, I know the path, I know how challenging it is for folks of color in this world and young people, particularly when they are told, when they're given no chance, you know, when their side of the world is, there's no green spaces, there's no, there's nothing but the kind of this desolate, you know, kind of environment and, you know, liquor stores at every corner and that kind of neighborhoods. And you're told that you're nothing and you're not going to be anything. You know, that's the world that we live in. Yeah. And that's why I'm so passionate about being a part of the awakening that we all need to have. Mm. Yeah. As it pertains to how race has everything to do with it.
Yeah.
It has everything to do with it in this country. Did I stop you? Yeah.
Hey, no. I'm just like, I'm, you know, just really hearing the way in which that kind of a thing just absolutely spins one out. I mean, you know, the way in which we got spun out was, you know, it was, you know, a father that was very despotic and I was rebelling and, you know, carrying all this anger around that he carried around and mother that wasn't well. So those were the things that led me to wake up through various, including psychedelics. But this is far more pernicious. I mean, you know, everyone's suffering is, they're suffering. Comparing it is, you know, it gets you into a place that's not productive. But I just want to, if you don't mind, because I looked at one of your lectures from Spirit Rock, right?
Oh.
That you did recently, and it's something. So a lot of what I do on mind rolling is about sharing with people, just bringing down into a practical level, just how to get your life somewhat in balance, right? And being able to move forward each day. Mm-hmm. So you did a talk that I really loved. It's around the paramours, right? And before you got into the nature of that, which I do want to hear from you, I love the, do you remember the bug story you told?
No, kinda, but not really. Can you tell it to me?
I think it was a friend of yours you were with. I'm not sure who, but yeah. She wanted to save a bug that had a sting.
Right.
And when she went to save it, she would get stung. Mm-hmm. And then she try again. She got stung, but she finally managed to move it out, get it away. And somebody mm-hmm. said, well, you know, why are you doing that? You're going to get, well, it's, she said, or you said, I can't remember who it was. It's just nature. It's the nature of the bug to sting. Yeah. It's the nature of a human to be good.
Yeah.
And try and help. Right.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful story. And it, you know, it says so much because, that's very difficult for us to stay in that. I mean, you're talking about a bug biting you and stinging you. Okay. You're immediately reactive, but right. How many times the way someone talks to you, the way someone looks at you, that right. pulls you out of a natural goodness.
Yeah. It's tough. It's not easy. It's not easy, you know, to not react and react to our environments and to all that around us that, you know, that stings us. It's just not easy. And I do think that it is, that's the path right there. You know, that's almost the whole of the path right there. And I've forgotten that story and now I may use it again. I think I only used it that one time. I got to get more like Jack who, you know, he's got his patent got story.
Yeah, right. I absolutely do that.
I'm a one-off.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, I think that that is the whole of the path. How do we stay in who we really are? How do we stay with and stay good regardless, even with life beating us up and having all of its all the dukkha that happens. How do we live through that and not be like the worldly winds that sway you from one place to the other? How do we actually achieve this equanimity, this place of equanimity that allows us to actually just hold everything, you know, and to, you know, to sway as little as possible, but to really be that container that's holding it. And it's to me, when I think about the path, and when I think about the Eightfold Path, when I think about all of what we're doing in the spiritual pursuit, is to be able to have a life, to be able to have the kind of mind that will allow us to stay centered, because we can't affect life. Life is going to happen. Things are going to happen to us. That is out of our control. But what is in our control is this mind that has a way of holding all of the ups and the downs, you know, the 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows.
Exactly.
Can we hold it in a way so that we can still be, you know, still live in our hearts as much as we can?
Yeah. It just reminds me of something. We're doing a memorial for Ram Dass when I'm here on Maui. This will probably come out after it, but it will be available to anybody, even if you didn't watch it live. And I started thinking about the most important things that Ram Dass transmitted that I wanted to talk about. And that was one of them. Well, his main thing of it's okay. We're human. You're going to have all of these dark motivations. You're going to have all of these emotional blah blahs go on and feel like you're being captured by your self-involvement. But you got to just, it's okay. So all through my relationship with him over many, many years, I remember one time I sat down for lunch with him in Santa Fe. We were on the board of the Taos Hanuman Ashram that's in Taos. Beautiful, beautiful temple. The only one of Neem Karoli Baba in America. So there was some divisive stuff going on. And I said, Ram Dass, geez, I wish we should just be family. People, this is not, you know, this is, look at what we've been given. We should all be family. He said to me, that's romantic. That's a romantic thought. But how about just being able to include everything in your
everything
in the circumference of your field, everything, and the divisiveness, the goodness, the positivity and the negativity, and obviously the ways. I had 100,000 beautiful visions and 100,000 horrible. So
life and death, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's all part of the soup here, and it's not going to change.
Well, one of the things in terms of you talked about was around what makes people whole, and there's a few prescriptions to that. And the first one, if you can just elaborate a little bit, but the first one was connection with our purpose. Now, purpose can have different meanings related to, one is related to success, but that is not what I believe we're talking about. And then there's, you know, following one's dharma, which is more related to what we came here to really share. So, talk about purpose a little bit. It's important.
I just want to back that up and say that, working with Greater Good Science Center out of UC Berkeley and Dr. Kelton, who has done amazing work. This is coming from his work about what makes people whole all over the world, no matter where they come from. Yeah. And there were the four pillars. We call it the four pillars. And it was we've kind of taken his work and put it into a four pillar context and saying that, you know, it's And purpose was number one, right? Being on purpose with your life. And so I think that for me, what I can do is talk about my own experience of purpose. My own experience of purpose has been really listening deeply to who I really am and to the voice that I don't think that I'm the only person on the planet that actually gets this deep voice that, and I think what we do, we shut it down, we shut her down, and we do something else. Purpose, we get so caught up with money that we think that money becomes our purpose. And that is where, that's like the wrong turn that we've made when we go towards money as purpose. And yet that's kind of what we've been fed, that if you're not making money, you know, you got to make sure you do make money. But, and money is important. Don't get me wrong, you know, one's purpose is way deeper than that. And I think that I talk to college students often. I'll go into a course and I'm talking to them and I'm going to Northwestern actually in a couple of weeks, and we'll be talking to some students there. And they always bring me in to talk to the entrepreneurial courses and things like that. And these young entrepreneurs are like, you know, and oftentimes they're told that they should do this and they should do that. And, you know, I have the same message, just like, listen to your gut, you know, just listen to your gut, and your gut is your purpose. It'll be clear if you don't clog it up with all of the distractions that people lay on us that have everything to do with the practicalities of life, so to speak. I have not worked for anybody my whole life but myself. I mean, I'm just that one, you know, and I know there's enough for everybody. And other people, their purpose is working at the post office. And I love that. There's a postal lady that I go to, and she loves her job. She's there with so much love, and she welcomes everybody and blesses everybody. And I say, you know what, you are so on purpose. And it's really lovely to see that. And so I don't have any kind of leaning towards anything other than to listen to one's heart and to see what one's purpose is. And we feel like, so often we feel like, I don't know why I'm here. I don't know why I'm here. And I think underneath that is, I know why I'm here, but I have another message that says, don't go there, and to do something different. I don't believe you don't know why you're here.
Well, it's a lot of pressure from so many different forces to say.
So much pressure. Yeah. So mm-hmm. much pressure. And it's real. And I get it. Yeah. And I get it. And but how do you balance it, at least, you know? Mm-hmm. How do you balance it? I look at somebody in my family who's been at a county job, LA County, her whole life, straight out of college. And just retired after, you know, being 75 years old, 72 years old. And it's like, and just never liked it. Her whole life just went by at the county, you know, and didn't listen. Yeah. So anyway, I just say that. I think that, because that lights us up. It's like, I ask the question, what makes you come alive? You know, that Robert Thurman, you know, quote, that because the world needs those who are alive. So that question I ask them, what makes you come alive? When you don't know what your purpose is, look at what makes you come alive. And people light up and they can say things that make them come alive, you know, but that's not, you know, a job or whatever it might be. So maybe it's not a job, but make it central in your life somehow. You know, how can you balance it? But doing what makes you come alive is really important.
Yeah, yeah. That's a great way to put it too.
Yeah.
Really great. And the other things that you have in this, what makes people whole. So I love that this purpose and connecting with real purpose is at the top. And then you've got some of the things for, as far as I'm concerned, which really support getting there, amongst other things, of course, connection to others.
Yeah.
Right. That's right. Generosity and compassion.
Right.
And as you said it, I believe connected to something greater than ourselves, even a feeling of awe.
The feeling of awe. Yeah. That's right. And it could be the moment of seeing a flower open up. Hmm. You know, seeing the color purple, as Alice Walker says, you know, when you walk by and see and don't see the color purple, you know, and it's sitting right there in front of you, you know, and how much awe that gives you when you see it. There's something way bigger than all of us. And when we connect to that, it's
faith. Faith happens when we connect with that, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah. But all of this is also reflective of how important Sangha is, satsang, or the Hindus, same thing, community of like-minded people. And, you know, we always talk about how the Buddha, when he was asked what's the most important refuge, you know, and said the Sangha. Yeah.
The Sangha.
And boy, are you know, we, of course, are finding that out big time. Not that we didn't know it or anything. I mean, we've been, Ram Dass has started all of that, the idea of the support of satsang sangha as an integral way on the path a long, long time ago. But when he left and another very close, his close Indian brother and one of our mentors left 3 weeks later, K.K. Shah, do you really know? People came over to where I was, you know, satsang, and we sat together, just naturally occurring. You know, it wasn't, hey, I'm going to handle this on my own, kind of, you know. That is not natural.
It's not natural. Not.
Just like our goodness is natural.
Yes. And
as you say, you know, we are relational.
We are relational.
How we support each other. You know?
That's exactly right. Yeah. That's exactly right. And that's who we really are. And it's wonderful when we, but you know, our message in this country, the rugged individual and, you know, and hyper individualism is at the root of our separation. And I'm always talking about going from me to we, you know, this meanness is really lonely and it's not even true. Yeah. You know, because we do everything we can to try to make me true is what's true, right? Yeah. That's the truth of it. And so when we go from me to we and just relax into the we-ness, sangha.
Interestingly that you brought this up, I'm working on a book about just that, from me to we.
Are you?
With a friend of mine. And we've just been talking about it, using ourselves as examples of how, you know, the development of the habitual patterns and the neurotic tendencies and how they enliven this great story that we're constantly involved with. Actually, Krishnadas, it was his little, he prompted me because he used to talk about in his talks, you wake up in the morning to the movie of me. You know, you're the star, you're the producer, you're the director, the writer, and it goes on 24/7. Okay. And then I think of Ram Dass in this movie, Becoming Nobody, that's out there, how he said, you know, when is what I want enough? When is what, you know, I need enough? It's much more interesting to see about helping somebody else than it is to constantly think about yourself all the time, which is, the great thing around service and so on. So I mentioned the 10 paramis, the 10 perfections that come from the Buddha. And I think I just like to run through them. Some of them are really obvious, but maybe we could just get you to explicate a little bit. And now, of course, generosity, we just talked about that. And morality and harmony all make sense. Then we get to one called renunciation. Okay. Now suddenly, as soon as you say renunciation, everyone backs off. Okay. It's either, okay, this is stuff. I can't do this. I can't even sit for 5 minutes. Never mind, you know, and do a little renunciation of that self-talk. I can't do that. Never mind, you know, right. So, but that's not what it's about. And it's about letting go of clinging, which you mentioned. And that's the grand recipe, of the Buddha is around that. Yes. Talk about how do we get people not to react so much about renunciation? Because it is a truism. We are doing that. We need to do that. I mean, need is a shit word too, but we really have to embody something that allows us to be able to be comfortable enough and feel safe enough to just let go of the kind, you know, all of the clinging that we do in a moment to moment basis. Yeah.
That's a good one. I mean, I think that is, like, as we know that, you know, when we look at the Four Noble Truths, you know, that's at the core of it, right? That's the prescription that the Buddha gave us, that it's the clinging is what causes our the dukkha, all of our suffering, and letting go is possible. Peace within ourselves is possible, and gave us a recipe of how to do that. And so the letting go to clinging is at the core of, if we really just go back to I'm suffering, something suffering within me. And if I trace it back, there's something that I'm either clinging to or pushing away. And not accepting what is in some way. And so that renunciation is a very difficult one. And it requires, and I call it the thinning of the self, you know, like we have these thick selves of who I am. And, you know, this is, Kanda is all these things. And it's really this thickness of my thoughts and how I think about things and my, you know, my views and my perceptions and everything about me. And as we start to thin the self, it's almost like, I feel it like, as we do practice and we start to carve away some of this that we understand that we actually are not even a noun, we're more of a verb, that we are really that which is moving and changing constantly. There's nothing really solid here, right? And as we start to understand that there's really nothing so solid here, and we're really more of a verb than we are this noun, and we start thinning the self, and the renunciation of that kind of letting go, really, it's just, it is so transformative. And that is how I experience it, as that just thinning and thinning, like taking a layer and another layer and a layer of all this unneeded meanness, you know, my wantingness, my neediness, who I amness. You know, I just yesterday, I have this meme, but you know, it's not unique, but yesterday I was wanting something so bad. What was it? It was something that was really, I wanted something really badly. And I said, and when I caught myself, I said, not me, not mine, not I, Conda. Not me, not mine, not I. And when I do that, I go, right. It's not me. It's not mine. It's not I. I can let that go. I can stop clinging and renounce whatever that is that I wanted. So that's my personal meme. But that's what I think it takes. We have to just start looking at who do, all these things that we think we are, when we really see that it's floating and changing. I mean, I'm not even the same person I was when we started this call. You know, there's some cells have changed and everything's moved, and yet we take ourselves as this thick thing. And so I do believe that if we can start looking at ourselves as, and really, this is, we're not making it up. We really are changing all the time. Yeah. And if we can actually accept that, then we can start to renunciate, I think. Mm.
Yeah, Buddha didn't make this stuff up. Come on, everybody.
No.
He did not.
Okay. No, it was empirical. No.
Yeah. And, oh, by the way, you ever hear Sharon talk about, like, when you just said, come on, Conda. I mean, let's get, you know, whatever you just said about relating with a desire. She has a name. Did you ever hear that?
No.
She calls herself Lucy.
Lucy, oh, that's her other person.
Yeah. That's so great.
I love it. Sharon. Lucy. Yeah. Poor Lucy.
Yeah. It's okay, Lucy. You'll be okay.
That's okay.
Don't hang on that tight. It's okay.
That's right. No, renunciation is really it. And also, I mean, you know, when we could think of ourselves as a going back to the awe, going back to something bigger than ourselves, going back to that, right? Going back to understanding that there's just this incredible life force that, you know, makes the world go round and the stars come out and the seasons and everything. We're all a part of this life force, and we're just a little part of it. And, you know, and we're not the king and queens of it either, quiet as kept.
We're not. Yeah,
No, take off your crown, buddy. Yeah.
I want to. I'm working on it, let me tell you. So a couple other things in the perfections and perfections. I kind of group these two together. I think that somehow there's a way in which if you can unite them, energy and patience, okay? So certainly one needs to have, when you realize, I mean, people aren't going to do nothing until you're suffering, right? We are suffering, right. And then we are going to be at least open to the possibility of what can be, what can come, what grace can come through to set us out to transform that suffering. Yeah. And certainly that's an energy to get that in you and go, okay, I'm going to move forward here. Because I want to change. I want, just at the basic level, I want to be happy. So energy is there. And then patience, understanding what you have been just saying. This is not permanent. Everything is changing. I'm not the same as I was when we first started chatting. So this energy and patience, I think that they go together. What do you think?
Yeah, I think you just said it brilliantly. Really, you just described it. I think you're right. They do go together. I mean, I don't think I can say it any better than what you said. I should be interviewing you, man. Mike.
I'm saying this too because I have I am deficient in patience myself.
Yeah.
And it is something, you know, there is some clinging I have to some projection of this is how to get stuff done, kind of, you know, the male aggression force. And to think, for me to be able to say to myself, okay, this is not going to be here 2 minutes from now. It's going to be, yeah, or 1 second. It's going to be completely different. Is so important to be able to just relax a little bit. So I love the patience idea, although I'm honestly, it's been a difficult path for me.
I think most people, it's funny because right now I'm on a WhatsApp group with a group of about, I don't know, there's about 30 of us on this WhatsApp group, all in teacher training, in Dharma teacher training. And everybody on this WhatsApp group right now, it's really fun. They're saying like, okay, this is the subject is paramis. What are you good at and what do you need more work on?
Really?
Which one are you best at and which one do you need more work on? And I'm telling you, the more work is on patience, almost all of
really?
Patience is has shown up more than any other one. Patience.
Wow. Okay. That made me feel better.
Yeah.
We're in it together then.
We're in it together. I mean, we live in a society that is just go, 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 go. And, you know, again, we're trained in this way. You know, my mom was famous for saying, you know, this too shall pass. This too shall pass. And this too shall pass.
Yeah. And then we have another couple that I think go together quite well. Truthfulness and loving kindness, which reflects, of course, how Neem Karoli Baba said to Ram Dass, tell the truth and love everyone. He said, I can't do that because I do not love everyone. And of course, Maharaji was coming from the one, not the little guy that can't do this stuff, coming from the place who we truly are. But that is being able to tell the truth and love and enact loving kindness in the same moment. In your own experience, how have you managed to traverse that path?
Well, I think when I think of truthfulness, I think of the two truths. You know, in our tradition, there's the two truths, which is there's the universal and there's the relative world. We live in the universal and we live in the relative. And they both are true and equally true. And we tend to think that, we like to think at times that the universal is really who we are. We're one, we're just one. And what that does is gets rid of the other truth of the relative, because the relative can be very hard to deal with, right? And so oftentimes also, what we'll do is that we will use the relative the universal truth as a way of answering the relative. But, you know, all these terrible things may be happening to people, but we're all one. And that is what I call spiritual bypass, right? And so I think that there are the two truths. And when I think of truthfulness and what I think that the Buddha is referring to, it's the two truths, that they both live in each other. That within the relative, the universal lives within the relative and the relative lives within the universal. And so it's almost like the yin and yang. There's a piece of each one inside. And so that is really the truth of existence. It is this relative world. There's this computer that I am on right now and you're there and I'm here and all these things are happening. And you know, and then there's this universal aspect of all life. And so I think that when we bring loving kindness into both the truth, both truths, the relative and the universal, that's when our hearts open. When we're able to do that, then I think we don't have to do the bypass and we're able to live in the truth of the relative, which is difficult. It's difficult. Not all the time, but it is difficult a lot. And that's why loving kindness is such an important ingredient, that we can keep our hearts open and not have to just jump to a universal, because within the universal, it's so easy to just say everything's fine. And, you know, and it's not always like that.
Yeah. And it goes back to, again, being able to embrace both the 100,000 beautiful visions and the 100,000 yep. horrible ones. And yep. Yeah.
Yep, that's right.
The other one that I want to discuss a little bit, it's the last one, it's equanimity. Mm-hmm. Ability to hold it all without judgment, yeah. with balance, right?
Yeah, I love equanimity.
Yeah, I mean, boy, oh boy, oh boy. I mean, I have been, I don't know if it's what's been happening this last 6 weeks with all of the loss and so on. I had health issues as well. I really had, I've had a tough time, mm-hmm. as you know, because I completely messed up twice our get together. Right?
I wasn't going to say anything about that. I wasn't going to tell anybody.
Right. What can I do?
Whatever.
Yeah. But
here we are.
I think the there's a certain level of sensitivity that happens with suffering that gets you deeper and deeper and much more aware of all of your motivations and all of the clinging and all of the attachment to me-me-ness, me-me land. Yeah. So it's, yeah. So I have been watching this, most especially the judgmental mind and seeing exactly how, boy, if anything puts you into a polarized place, more than absolutely anything, of course, is this judgmental mind. Talk about that a little bit.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, that's a hard one, the judgmental mind. I mean, and then we judge the judging, you know. When we're trying to get out of the judging, we start judging the fact that we're judging. And
circular, Jesus.
It's circular, yeah. Yeah, again, going back to how do we go from a judging mind to an equanimous mind to that which is that. And that's why mindfulness, I just have to say, the practice. That's why the practice is so important, you know? I go back to practice. And what mindfulness practice does is just kind of allows you, it allows one to see one's own habits of mind, you know? Because we're so caught in it. We're so in it that we are it as opposed to, you know, watching it. And mindfulness is just the antidote for so many things, not for everything. I mean, it's not, you know, but I got to tell you, when it comes to these kinds of questions that you're asking me, a real mindfulness practice really allows, it slows things down. It allows us to see, it allows us to watch what's our pattern of our mental patterns, and creates a gap between reacting and the stimulus and reaction. And in that gap is where we get to choose, we get our freedom, we get to be able to see and even laugh at ourselves, you know, and even laugh, there you go again, there you go again. And so I just have to say that mindfulness, honestly, the practice is what is leads us to help us with being non-judgmental and having that mind that is of equanimity. It's it really actually works. You know, I know everybody talks about mindfulness this and mindfulness this, like it's, you know, it's the popular flavor of the month, but it actually works. You know, I can't even imagine myself without my practice. You know, like how do you negotiate this world? That's, yeah, I don't know how people negotiate this world without some kind of practice. It doesn't have to be mindfulness, but something that is going to, you know, be kind of truth-telling and loving. Mm-hmm. And so that said, I know that my practice has everything to do with it. And I just say, you know, sit. That's very helpful.
I introduced Ram Dass talks in a podcast called Ram Dass Here and Now. And at one point in this last thing, he said, I was always looking forward to meditation. It was a chance to sit down and shut up, you know, just get down to it, right? It's a chance to sit down and shut up. And the other great practice before mindfulness was any kind of, you know, pop word, shall we say, his thing was around the witness, with basically mindfulness, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And encouraging people to be the witness, but very difficult also, because boy, you can, the ego can grab that on and be the judge and jury witness, which is not what we're talking about either in using his particular thing,
right,
or mindfulness. And that's why I love his thing that he talked about most in the last few years was around loving awareness and moving your perspective into your spiritual heart and being able to witness this incarnation with love and humor is what his big things were. So that's
so important.
Yeah, absolutely.
I agree.
Crucial. Yeah.
I agree. And I think that, you know, that it's right here. It's easy. It's not easy to do, but we have everything we need, just ourselves and, you know, a little space of quiet. And if we can make that a habit, it's powerful.
Yeah.
It's really powerful.
Yeah. A life in balance is possible. We all know that. So.
Totally.
Yeah. But there's so much. I need to do a few more podcasts with you, Kanda. I mean, we want to talk about, here's some of the different things Kanda talks about: activism, racism, and the spiritual path, social justice, next economy. I mean, you are something else. That's all I got. Permacultural design, you've been involved.
Permaculture.
Right? See,
that's my most favorite thing to talk about, is soil and the earth. I love that. I mean, it is all life right there. All life is based on soil and what is in that soil. And so I think that it's so important for us to have the opportunity. That's why I look at, again, I go back to neighborhoods where there's no green spaces and it's just cement. Mm-hmm. And then you see people and under conditions. That separation is so cruel, because it's within the soil and touching the earth is all wisdom is there.
Yeah.
And so many of us don't have that opportunity. You know, I was listening to something I have been Amy Goodman this morning, and a woman was in New York, in San Francisco, changing a rule in prisons that men have to be able to see the sun at least once a week.
Whoa.
They will go in solitary and spend years not ever seeing the sun. How is that anything? How is that possible that we can do that? Not seeing the sun. And she's right now creating a something, a city, trying to get that passed in San Francisco. That has to stop. And so right now, temporarily, they're doing 1 week, 1 hour a day, which is huge. 1 hour a day to see the sun.
Oh my.
Yeah.
My.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, we, I'm sorry, but I am truly believe that I know what the earth, we are just earth. We are earth. We are earth standing and walking and talking and making decisions. And the elements are all important to our beingness. And when we are not in touch with them, when we live in the concrete jungle, it has repercussions.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for all of this, Kanda. And everybody, by the way, you're going to go to BeHereNowNetwork.com. Mind rolling, and you're going to see in the show notes all of the different links to different things that Kanda is involved with, and we're going to make it easy for you. And other than that, again, I want to thank you for being here, Conda, and everybody, this is Mind Rolling, and we shall see you next week.
Thanks so much. I'm happy to be here. Take care.
Thank you.